Now we have Joseph Spradley, the former Academic Fellow at Wheaton College now. So he's still teaching.
Retired in May.
Retired in May after, would you say, 48 years? And he will be speaking on the Christian roots of the scientific revolution.
Just returned from teaching 5 weeks in Kenya, Daystar University. I don't know if you are familiar with that, and I can't resist the water from any source. Well, this talk is about early Christian roots of the scientific revolution. I don't think that was in the abstract, the early part, but I think we'll see that as the case. And I would like to begin with Galileo, however. Galileo's contributions to the scientific revolution. You can see that stamped in Mal di Violence, but it shows some of his discoveries, the moon of Jupiter, the telescope there in the corner, and so on. I think it's quite clear now that Galileo himself was a very committed Christian. Doubt that Galileo's daughter, at least a book by Dalla Sable, I think certainly establishes that from his communication with his daughter. What I'd like to try to argue today are some of the influences on Galileo, but let me begin by just commenting briefly on Galileo's contributions, especially those that contributed to our new view of the world, the idea that the Earth is in motion, moving around the sun, which of course changes everything, completely new perspective, and we mark pretty much the beginning of modern science. But of course, Galileo, unlike Athena, did not spring directly full blown from Zeus, never Zeus. And there are many roots that we can try to trace. First of all, though, just to review quickly, the principle of inertia over against Aristotle's idea that motion requires a mover. This was very much a part of his description of projective motion, horizontal motion being a constant speed. Although we should point out that he did not have the full Newtonian or Cartesian concept of inertia, that in fact, perhaps to convince his Aristotelian doubters, he still retained something of a circular concept of inertia. In fact, the word horizontal, the root is horizon, which in fact is a circle, and Galileo argues that motion can be at a constant speed without a mover, precisely because even on Earth, it's a kind of circular motion, bringing the concept of circular perfection, I guess, down to Earth. Of course, this is also required for a moving Earth. If you're going to have an Earth in motion, you don't see any angels pushing the Earth. We must have some kind of principle of inertia before we can make very much sense out of the concept of Earth in motion. And the same is true, of course, of the void. The Earth can't move through some kind of material medium very easily, or it would be presumably slowed down by friction, although that didn't seem to bother Descartes and his concept of theism. But again, Galileo takes the position against Descartes that there can be a void, nature doesn't necessarily have a war of action. Another principle of Galileo is the concept of gravity, independent of mass, and a mathematical description, precise kind of description, because Galileo's just referring to, and eventually generalized by Newton to account for planetary motions. Third concept, the unity of the heavens and the earth, over against the Aristotelian concept of the perfection of the heavens, the divinity of the heavens. Galileo, perhaps especially as he began to use the telescope, recognizes very soon celestial imperfections, mountains on the moon, sunspots. He refers to the ears of Saturn, or bumps on Saturn. Telescope couldn't resolve the rings, but he recognized that those were clearly imperfections. And so he began to move then towards a modern view of the laws of nature applying both to the heavens and the earth. And then, of course, the empirical emphasis, it's a matter of confirmation of his ideas by observation and experiment. He didn't simply do experiment in the laws of the experiments. He began with mathematical arguments, but the tradition of experimental confirmation. What I want to look at then are both ancient and medieval influences on Galileo. And I'll look at especially the work of Plotinus, but in the medieval period, those tests often were done, Lane and others, which we will not refer to in any detail, but we move first to the early church background. The church fathers, I think it's a mistaken impression that is sometimes taught that, that the early church didn't believe in the deity of Christ. That was something that eventually was introduced to Christianity. In fact, it was the deity of Christ that was foremost in their thinking before the humanity of Christ really began to become an important emphasis in the monastic period, to some extent. The deity of Christ, especially with respect to the Logos theology, the idea of that creation being according to the laws of God, the creation of a rational world, and so on. Let me just mention a couple of quotes. Justin Martyr, I think, second century, on the Greek rational tradition. Whatever has been uttered aright by any man in any place belongs to us Christians. For next to God we worship and love reason, logos, which is from God. The Greek father did not reject the Greek tradition of logic and reason, and as a result, Christianity was able to benefit from that inheritance. Another quote, we often think of Tertullian as challenging that Greek reason. What is there in common between Athens and Jerusalem, but between the academy and the church? Weigh with all projects for Stoic or the dialect of Christianity. But on the other hand, another quote from Tertullian makes it clear that he accepted the Logos argument. God made this universe by his word and reason and power. The philosophers also are agreed that the artificer of the universe seems to be Logos. Now, John Plotinus is a bit later, 6th century, early 6th century. Perhaps the first Christian scientific thinker, arguably, we could identify him as such, perhaps not as well known as some of the other early church fathers. I'll comment on in a moment, but let me read from evaluation by George Sarton, our historian of the 20th century. Plotinus, a Christian, wrote commentaries on Aristotle. In spite of his scholastic tendencies, he was undoubtedly the most original thinker of that time. By the way, was one of the last directors of the Alexandrian Museum. Greatest physicist of the age was Plotinus, Sarton says. He refused to accept the Aristotelian theories on motion, on the impossibility of vacuum. He had some vague notion of what we call inertia. These ideas, when placed in their proper background, are so strikingly original, so daring, and yet so prophetic of modern mechanics that Plotinus has been called a forerunner of Galileo. This may seem an exaggeration, yet he was the greatest mechanician within the very long period which extended from Archimedes to Giordano in the century. Aloppinus, as perhaps the first Christian scientist, had a special emphasis on deity, the deity of Christ. He was born in the Coptic tradition, which is Monophysite. They believed that Christ is essentially God and that not completely human. I have a question mark because Aloppinus, in developing his Christology, claimed that he believed in an orthodox view of Christ, the humanity of Christ, but his emphasis, along with that of other Monophysites at the time, and Coptics right at the present time, was on the deity of Christ. And according to Sambursky, the first to combine cosmology with monotheism, an emphasis on the unity of nature versus the divinity of the heavens. Quote from Aloppinus, "One star differeth from another star in glory," says Paulus. "Indeed, there is much difference among them in magnitude, color, and brightness. And I think that the reason for this is to be found in nothing else than the composition of the matter of which the stars are constituted. They cannot be simple bodies, or how could they differ but for their different constitution?" So we recognize that the heavens were made of perishable material, kinds of substance. He felt as a Christian and academician that his task was a systematic critique of Aristotle, and in the process introduced new concepts of motion that suggest, or that I'm going to argue, probably had an influence on various steps on Galilee himself. I believe in creation rather than an eternal world. That was one of the most telling critiques of Aristotle. Material stars moving in the void. He even did simple experiments on free fall, independent weight, projectile motion, and what he calls impetus. Instead of motion requires a mover. Impetus, I guess, is more of a medieval term. Sometimes I think it's translated from Aloppinus as a motive power that the thrower imparts to the projectile that's being thrown. A kind of quality given to that object, like heating it up and giving it a higher temperature. And eventually that became the impetus concept, and then eventually the Galileo, the term inertia, was introduced. Quoting from Aloppinus, "If one lets fall simultaneously from the same height, two bodies differing in weight, one will find that the ratio of their times of motion does not correspond to the ratio of their weights, but the difference in time is very small." So he apparently has done the experiment that we usually credit to Galileo. Another quote, "Some incorporeal kinetic power is imparted by the thrower to the object thrown. An arrow or a stone is projected by a force in a void, the same thing will happen much more easily, nothing being necessary except throw." Aloppinus also is credited with an early treatise on the astrolabe. He was interested, of course, in the problems with setting the church calendar, the drawing of the things that Christ determined in the Easter, which was kind of a complex process and required a bit of astronomical knowledge. Now let me turn to the influence of Aloppinus briefly. He had a rather profound influence on Islamic science, the development of the astrolabe, and impetus theory. Although in Islam, they tended to view impetus as a self-dissipating force, and never applied it to celestial motion. That is, was, I assume, when you see a projection of motion that eventually it slows down the effect of friction, and then you then think of this as somehow being a dissipating kind of force. Whereas a lot of us apply this concept, even the motions of the celestial spheres. God created the celestial spheres, imparted impetus to them, and they continue to move without any dissipating influence. In the medieval period, Bourdain picked up some of the ideas of Alapinus. I believe the translation was done a little after Bourdain's time, but he must have been aware of some of the ideas. And, for example, Bourdain says it is unnecessary to posit intelligences as the movers of celestial bodies. When God created the celestial spheres, he began to move each of them as he wished. They are all still moved by the impetus that he gave them, because the impetus is neither corrupted nor diminished. So it's beginning to return to the original concept of Alapinus, which had been somewhat modified within Islam. Now, as to the influence on Galileo, a couple of centuries after Bourdain, the Physica of Alapinus was translated in 1535. But that was in time for Galileo, who had been well aware of Alapinus' writing. And in fact, in the early notebooks of Galileo, there is rather frequent mention of Alapinus. In the Motu, one of his early publications, he argues for the void and for impetus. It was only later that he begins to use the term inertia. Kuhn, for example, suggests that this inertia concept is the major paradigm shift that led to the scientific revolution. I recently got a hold of Galileo's early notebooks, Physical Questions, translation by William Wallace, and was interested to find more references to Alapinus than almost any other source out of maybe as many as 100 sources, I can count them all, but only 5 had more references than Alapinus. Plato only had 14 references as compared to 15 to Alapinus. Of course, Aristotle, I think, had 100 references, Aquinas about 50 references, so some of those scholastic sources were still very much in the fore during his student days. But let me quote this from a couple of typical references that are usually rather brief, but in one section on the universe, fourth question whether the universe would have existed from eternity. A third opinion is that of Alapinus in the book in which he replies to the arguments of Proclus, a contemporary of Alapinus, for the eternity of the world. So he was accepting Alapinus' arguments for creation as an eternal world. And on the heavens, fourth question, are the heavens corruptible? First opinion is that of Alapinus, holding that the heavens are corruptible of their very nature, and that sometime they will finally become corrupt. This is gathered from the solution of the sixth argument against Proclus, and from Simplicius, who contributes this opinion to him. Both of those are interesting to read to see how completely immersed Galileo was as a student in scholastic arguments, but beginning to take particular attention toward the ideas of Alapinus. Now, I want to move to one other area just somewhat quickly to give people time to consider the first woman scientist. That's arguable that those are verbing. And I think what we see in the monastic emphasis beginning in the 7th or 8th century, but especially about the 10th and 12th century, an increasing emphasis on the humanity of Christ, the deity of Christ, and some of the ideas that emerge from it that are important for science, being rather well developed, but the humanity of Christ had not. Perhaps going back even to St. Benedict, the 7th century, manual labor, idleness is the enemy of the soul, therefore at fixed times the brothers ought to be occupied in manual labor, again at fixed times in sacred reading, but if the needs of the place or poverty demand that they labor at the harvest, they shall not grieve at this, but then they are truly monks, and they live by the laborers of their hands, as did our fathers and the apostles. So we begin to get now not just a kind of theoretical, speculative approach in the monastic tradition, but the emphasis on manual labor, which eventually leads into the celebration of the goodness of nature in the Franciscan tradition. From St. Francis, praise be you, my Lord, though our sister, Mother Earth, sustains and governs us, and produces berry fruits with colored flowers and herbs. This new celebration of nature, a part of the emphasis on God's creation, very much a part of the new emphasis on humanity of Christ, who himself was a carpenter, who worked with his hands, who celebrated the natural world. So, turning finally to Hildegard of Bingen, 7th century, Benedictine abbess, and her particular emphasis on the humanity of Christ is very earthy, down to earth. Among the first to benefit from Latin translations of Arabic sources and to revive Greek ideas of unities, although some of her most original ideas were even before she read some of those Latin translations. George Sarton again says that her the most distinguished naturalist and the most original medical writer of Latinum in the 12th century. Her first book, Mysterious, Mediation, 751. In this book, she uses arguments from the Greek tradition for elements, but in an egg-shaped universe rather than spheres, which she adopted later on. I'll show you some figures in a moment. But it's interesting because some have argued, I think, implied among others, that Kepler's idea of elliptical orbits came from not from the Greco-Roman tradition, which was so fixed on the circle, but on more of the Germanic traditions that also had emphasis on other shapes than the sphere as having value. And that she perhaps adopted that early on, and eventually shifting the spheres. Her emphasis on Neoplatonic emphasis on man as a macrocosm of the universe, but the emphasis of matter is not evil. The second book, describes some 230 plants, 60 trees with medical applications. She began the tradition of German classification. Her books were even being published as late as the 16th century and used in medical schools. Last book, called The Cures on Cosmic Medicine, and it gets a little more mystical. But here she is receiving her revelation, Walmart recording her revelations. We've argued that she used that technique because women would otherwise not be listened to at the time. A vision of the Trinity, some have argued, is particularly the kind of iconography might suggest a migraine headache, but kind of infectionistic argument. A couple of pages from Causes and Cures. This is an early diagram, an early vision of the cosmos on the left, and then Charles Singer's attempt to explain it. But I find a couple of things interesting in this. Not only the egg-shaped universe or the orbits of the planets, but the stars apparently spread out rather than fixed on a celestial sphere. You don't get that really until the 16th century would dig the first English translation of the Copernican system, because it suggests that stars are not simply located on the celestial sphere. Well, a couple of translations to give you later thinking that there are four elements. The upper are celestial, lower terrestrial. Things that live in the upper ones are palpable and made of fire and air. Those that move in the lower are palpable and consist of water and mud. The spirits are fiery and airy, but man is watery and muddy. And God created man. The mud from which he was formed was stuck together with water. And God put a fiery and airy breath of life into that form. Certainly, much more at home with the physical nature of human beings as we see. And then another quote, just as the body and soul exist together, strengthened by each other, so too our firmament and planets cherish and strengthen each other mutually. The soul vivifies and consolidates the body, so too sun, moon, and other planets cherish and strengthen each other with their fire. Now, this is a later beginning with regard to more of a spiritual view of the universe. I don't have time to go into detail, but a view of man as a microcosm, the larger macrocosm, just to the image perhaps. Just to conclude how we start up. New attitudes and values of Christological thinking on the deity and humanity of Christ began to offer a new basis for the scientific revolution. Philoponus challenged perfection and the unity of the heavens in favor of the unity of all between the order devised by Gordon and UNC Galileo. Hildegard sparked a reawakening interest in science, placing a positive value on the material world and initiating a new effort to describe.
Very brief time for questions.